From WHQR Public Media, this is a special edition of The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're sitting down for a candid conversation with Spence Broadhurst, a former Wilmington mayor who has played an intimate role in the creation and evolution of the New Hanover Community Endowment. 6 years ago, Broadhurst co-chaired the Partnership Advisory Group, which was put together to help steer the sale of New Hanover Regional Medical Center. And as the deal with Novant Health came together and the county planned on setting aside $1.3 billion in sale proceeds to create the endowment, Broadhurst was named to the board and shortly afterward named the inaugural chairman. This week, both Broadhurst and current endowment chairwoman Shannon Winslow, also a founding member, were both at the end of their second terms and both had asked to be reappointed by the county. County commissioners unanimously reappointed Winslow, but voted along party lines to replace Broadhurst. Now, I don't think that decision was particularly surprising for people following the endowment, or for Broadhurst, for that matter. Although there was some tension around the appointment vote, and we'll get into that later in today's conversation. But the main reason I wanted to sit down with Broadhurst is that he's been involved for longer and more intimately with the endowment than almost anyone else, and has helped shape its direction, for better or worse. Broadhurst, who has now resigned from the endowment to prevent any conflict that would prevent him from speaking candidly, agreed to this long-form interview, with the caveat that he would not discuss personnel issues, like the departure of the endowment's first two CEOs, William Buster and Dan Winslow, or talk about any specific board members. Over the course of this interview, we'll get into some of the challenges the endowment has faced, and some of the debates the board has tackled over where the now $1.6 billion organization should be headed. It is, I hope, a refreshingly transparent look inside one of the most important boardrooms in the region. All right, Spence Broadhurst, thank you very much for being here today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, man.
Okay, so you have wrapped up your second term on the endowment's board. You've been there for almost 5 years, and you were on the partnership advisory group before that during the sale exploration. So I think you have probably had a more of a front row seat and more of a hand in this whole process over the last 6 years than just about anyone else. And that's where I want to start. You know,
sure.
I mean, just looking back over the last 6 years, what are your sort of top line thoughts here?
Yeah, I have been. And, you know, listen, I'm not a philanthropist by training. You know, my role is really governance, is structure, organization, policy, governance. And so we started with a blank piece of paper almost. Not really. I mean, we had governing documents, the asset purchase agreement, the agreement with the attorney general, or the two main ones. And so we developed our policies around that. And so, one of my goals, one of the things I'm very proud of is that under my leadership when I was chair and also as chair of the governance committee, have set up a strong foundation of governance rules that are consistent with our founding documents. And you know, that's not sexy stuff, but it's important stuff because it really, our funding depends on it. Our future existence really, in my opinion, depends on it. So not just setting up the endowment correctly, but requiring ourselves to adhere to those policies is something I've done as chair of the governance committee. And from time to time, there have been board members that would, either because they didn't understand or intentionally wanted to stray from that. And I've kind of been the watchdog. So no, we have got to stick to our governing documents and also consistent with the strategic plan of the county.
So I want listeners to understand that, you don't intend to talk about specific board members or personnel issue, but can you broadly say, you know, what were some of the pressures to maybe stray from those founding documents?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear. One of the critical things, and it's clear in the asset purchase agreement, and it's translated into our bylaws, is that we as the endowment cannot supplant funding from government. Like, if government is typically funding a project or a process or whatever it is, our founding documents do not allow that to be transferred to the endowment.
So, for example, payroll for sheriff's deputies or teachers.
Exactly. Things like that. And it doesn't say items that are legally required, the county, it says that are typically required. So typically required would be historical, what's been done in the past. And so there have been a board member of two or endowment member of two that wanted to do that. And I would just, I would call it out and say, we cannot do that. We, in my opinion, by doing that, we jeopardize, we go against our founding documents and we jeopardize our frankly, our existence. And we can't do that. And a couple of times it was from a board member just not understanding, a relatively new board member not understanding. But there have been a case or two where a board member that you're familiar with who knows dang well that it would be inconsistent in his or her own way thought it was a good idea. And so we've had, I hate to be the watchdog, but I've kind of been the watchdog and pushed back. And that's created a rift a little bit here and there just on things like that.
What do you make of situations that might be seen as edge cases there? Like, I'll give you some for examples. Stepping in to help round out the funding for the State Aquarium, which is a government project, or, you know, funding something that's going to help provide wraparound services in schools. I have heard from many people in the community who feel like that is a slippery slope, and some of them are excited about that, and some of them are unhappy about that. But in both cases, I know, especially after the aquarium grant, I saw a lot of chatter on the county email server, people saying, like, is this now open season to fund government projects? So how did you think about that project?
Again, I go by the letter and the spirit of the founding documents. That's what we go back to. You know, in the United States, we go back to our Constitution. In this, we go back to the Asset Purchase Agreement. The Asset Purchase Agreement says that we cannot fund things or supplant funding for things. It doesn't say we can't fund them. It says we can't supplant funding for items that are typically funded by the government. So in the case of aquarium, that is a state organization, but they raised a ton of private money, and what the endowment agreed to do was to be the end of the part of the private fundraising. It did not supplant government. It did not remove something that has typically been funded by the government. It was private funding that was doing the expansion, and so we were a part of that. So that's clearly permissible, clearly acceptable. We have to continue to go back and be diligent about that asset purchase agreement. And so, and in my opinion, the aquarium easily fit into our funding allowance.
Let me just ask, since we're talking about the founding documents. I mean, this is I think people forget sometimes, it's a very young organization.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to, you know, the Constitution, America is a young country. You're a very young
yes.
organization.
Yes.
So, are you confident that what you and the sort of the founding members of the board have put in place, do you feel like that will hold? Or do you think that pressure will eventually, you know, kind of erode that?
Well, it's holding right now, but it does take diligence, and it takes an understanding of the founding documents. And your question leads to a good point, is that the farther we get away from that, the farther we get away from the institutional knowledge, the more we play musical chairs with the board members. The farther the county gets away from the founding documents, the more risk we have that we don't follow them to the letter and the spirit of the law. And so I think my advice for the remaining members of the endowment is just diligence, and it's an intentional diligence. It doesn't just happen by itself. Somebody has got to take control of that and have intentional diligence on it. So the risk is there. I mean, it's very real, actually. If we're not careful and don't intentionally have someone in charge of the governance that goes back to those founding documents.
So let me ask you a different kind of question, given, you know, just you having watched this whole thing be put together and then, you know, go through its first couple of years and now maybe hitting something more of a stride. How has it been for you to watch the evolution of how the endowment has been putting money out into the community from that first year, which I think you and I have spoken about, which was, a bit frustrating for some people, I think, both on the board and in the community, to something that seems like there's been, you know, larger, more strategic grants. So how have you seen that evolution?
Well, the evolution, again, has been intentional. And it's been a lot of hard work for the board members, and they've done a great job. And I'm proud of what I was a part of, and I'm proud of what they are doing. We have a solid strategic plan. We have, you heard formerly called it the rainbow, which kind of outlines the different types of grants that we can make, because one grant size doesn't fit all. And so all that's in place and is solid, and I'm very proud of that evolution, because if you see, you know, we made the multifaceted grant for the healthcare industry and trying to train and came more nurses and that, you know, that was a really good collaborative effort between the school system, the community college, and the university and the chamber. And that's consistent with our strategic plan, and I think we're in very good shape from that standpoint. My concern, though, you know, and so looking back, yeah, it's been an evolution. You know, it is a young organization, and we've had to evolve, and I think we're in a very good place. I can't go any further without pausing for a second and saying how proud I am of our staff. We have an excellent staff. You know, with Sophie's leadership, and they're just working their hindsides off, and they're doing a great job of getting that in place, and they really have worked hard. So we're in a good place. We really are. I think the question is, where do we go from here? That's the bigger question. It's not where we've come from. That's well documented. It's where do we go from here?
I agree with you. I think that is the question on most people's minds, and I don't think it's too beneficial to go back and relitigate, you know, past grants. But I will ask about the healthcare grant, because I think it is such a good and powerful grant. I think we will really see a return on that investment that I think some people, haven't wrapped their minds around yet. I also think that, you know, that grant involved, you know, it came to the endowment, as I understand it, with some pretty bright people attached to it, with some large organizations that had the capacity to do this work. UNCW has capacity. CFCC has capacity. Sure. The chamber knows what they're doing. The school district, most of the time, knows what they're doing. And that is, I mean, it just seems to me like that is a very high bar. And it seems like in other fields, in other pillars that the endowment is addressing, there isn't that kind of natural synergy between organizations, because, you know, the college and UNCW and the school already have working relationships. And there isn't the capacity where there's staff and there's know-how and institutional knowledge to come together and come to the endowment and say, here's what we want to do. And the path between where we are right now with hundreds and hundreds of nonprofits, many of which are siloed, many of which do not have experience working with each other, and something like that is truly transformational, where you guys are going to make a generational change with that healthcare grant. Where do you think the endowment needs to go to get to that place where you have more of those big collaborative projects?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways, but one, that collaborative project would not have happened if Natalie English and the Chamber of Commerce haven't stepped in and became the hub. You know, sure, the community college and university and even the school system may have worked together in some collaborative manners before, but not like this. This is new territory for all of them. And the reason it happened was because of the leadership of the Chamber of Commerce. And so Natalie and her team stepped in and brought them together and kept them together and organized it. And they can, and I've talked to Natalie. She's anxious to do it in other sectors. They can do this again, and they will if given the opportunity. So whether it's housing, whether it's workforce housing, where the homelessness issue, the unhoused that we've had a lot of conversation over in the last few weeks, you know, there are ways to do that. So I would encourage entities to engage the Chamber of Commerce, because they have the capacity and they have the skill set to make that happen. Another way is, you know, the endowment may choose to do it themselves. You know, there's two sides to that. You know, do we get into that business, right? And so that's another conversation. But we do have good, competent people in leadership roles at the endowment that can lead some of those things, kind of pull those together. But collaboration is the secret to this transformational change. I mean, we'll continue. I say we all own this endowment, so I'll say we. We'll continue to do small grants and things in ways that will make immediate kind of impacts. But the big transformational things are going to need collaboration. And I've had conversations again with Natalie English, and she's eager to do that. And I think that's it's a good model. I mean, they put it together in the healthcare. I think you can use the same model in other areas.
I mean, I have heard from people in the housing industry, for example, because there was, you know, a whole series of ongoing conversations with folks at the endowment, with people in the housing world, that seems to have stalled out. And it is what I hear, that people are looking for that kind of, you know, someone to be the hub, someone to be the referee, someone to be the collaborative, the team mom, whatever you want to call it. And I think, you know, it's been a couple of years since the healthcare grant, and I think some people are frustrated and looking for that. Yeah. And so one thing I have heard, and we heard this from former CEO and President Dan Winslow, was that one thing the endowment could do is this sort of multi-step process where you are putting out RFPs or RFQs for research papers. You know, let's get the brightest minds. We got money. Let's give a little research funding to the brightest minds in the country and see how other people have already maybe cracked these nuts. Mm-hmm. And then turn those research papers, which would be, you know, sort of public facing, into, you know, the starting point for a collaboration. And I mean, that was promised. I think you guys brought on, was it Chris Prentice from UNCW?
He was working with us on a consultant role, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, the role probably more important than the person, but someone who could, you know, take up that task of letting the endowment be the thought leader instead of mm-hmm. waiting for someone else to be the thought leader. To be candid with you, I haven't seen the endowment really, really step into that role yet. You know, are there conversations about that? Is that a place you think the board would like to go?
And there, you know, again, I'm no longer on the board, but I would say there are differences of opinion. You know, there are some that feel like the endowment should just be a funding source. There are some that feel like it should take a leadership role. I personally tend to think, again, that there are outside resources like the Chamber of Commerce that we can rely on to do that. But we've got people on staff right now that are very competent and able to do it. You know, they're limited in their time and et cetera. You know, they're filtering through $100 million in grant requests right now. And so you know, there aren't so many hours in the day. But I would say those are discussions that the board has, and I don't think there's a total consensus on that direction. And you brought, you know, not to kilter off path, but you know, we were talking earlier about concerns about adherence to the asset purchase agreement and getting far enough away not to understand it. The same challenge is on the county commissioners. You know, one of the things I assume at some point we'll talk about the fireworks.
Oh, we're going to get to it, yeah.
At the show yesterday, but one of the things I found out in having conversations with the county commissioners as they sit now is they don't fully understand the asset purchase agreement. They don't fully understand the endowment. Some of them don't fully understand what the endowment can and can't do. For example, you know, we talked about the workforce housing, the affordable housing. There was a coalition between the city and the county, and they were going to do certain things over 5 years and committed funding for it. And on top of that, which is very consistent with our strategic plan, the endowment made grants and commitments that on top of what the city and the county would do, we're going to do these other things, right? And that's how it's supposed to work, to raise the tide, you know, and so... And our understanding in when we made that commitment to workforce and affordable housing was that it was on top of what the city and county did. In the last budget session, the county chose to withdraw from that that agreement. And one of the comments that was made by one of the commissioners was, well, we don't need to do that. The endowment is funding that. Well, that is a clear misunderstanding of what the endowment can and can't do. The endowment cannot step in to a previously funded governmental role by our bylaws. We can't do that. And we did not do that. But that county commissioner thought it was perfectly fine to remove that from their budget since we had done it. And so I challenge, we deserve better than that. And I challenge everybody to hold us all accountable to that. Hold the endowment board members accountable to our founding documents and hold county commissioners and anybody who aspire to be a county commissioner to those guidelines.
Again, I don't want to go back and relitigate the budget, but I would ask, you know, I heard from people, you know, that was a conservative Republican commissioner we're talking about, Dane Scalise. But I heard from people on both sides of the aisle that said—
Actually, that was Commissioner Pierce that
said
that.
Oh, it was Pierce.
Yes.
All right. I'd heard similar sentiments from Scalise. But in any case, I have heard from, you know, fiscal conservatives who say, we are more than happy to have the county back away from some of this stuff and, you know, let the endowment do it. But I have also heard, you know, from folks on the left side of the political spectrum who said they were kind of, you know, disappointed that the county had walked away from a $50 million housing bond and gone with a, you know, more measured five-year pilot program, basically. Mm-hmm. And who said, you know, they did want the endowment to step in. So I felt like there was, from two different directions, political pressure from both sides for the endowment to move into the housing, basically moving to housing space.
And listen, it's consistent with our strategic plan. There was unanimous support from the board members and we developed a very comprehensive, collaborative approach to the grants from the endowment. We were eager to do that. It's on everybody's mind. It's a critical issue in our county, and we want to be part of that solution. But what we don't want to be is moving government responsibility to the endowment. That's not acceptable in the asset purchase agreement or our bylaws. And so we went in full faith that we were over and above, and then the county later pulled their funding, and it turned out that was not the case. And what, you know, there's nothing the endowment can do about that. But that's not, you know, I don't think that's appropriate, and I think that that our community deserves better.
Fair enough. I want to ask about a different pressure that I've heard about, and this is whether or not the endowment should lean so hard into the transformational change language that we have heard from both CEOs. I've heard from some folks that it might be better if you were essentially an ATM for a couple of years, mm-hmm. While maybe more, you know, quietly building the capacity of some nonprofits. And I say this because with William Buster and then Dan Winslow making pretty bold promises, you know, the endowment will transformationally change New Hanover County. That is a big promise. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about ending racial and economic inequality, restoring the black middle class, giving us world-class healthcare, world-class schools, things that have not happened, right? And I constantly hear frustration from the public about that, and I wonder if this is, to a certain extent, do some members of the board feel like that is a self-inflicted wound by using that word transformational so frequently?
Yeah, I don't think I'm individually qualified to say exactly. I do not think that the endowment should back off its responsibility and commitment to transformational change. I just don't think we should. Now, you know, your question is, should we use the word so often that people think, well, transformational change will happen this month and we should be seeing it? Yeah, you know, that's, you know, and we'll talk a little later on about communication, you know, but there's two parts of communication, is what you said and what somebody else hears. And that's kind of where that is. You know, I don't think either of our former CEOs spoke out of school at all. I think the full board feels the same way. It's just that transformational change is a long-term project. It ain't going to happen this month, this year, or probably in these 5 years. It might happen in this generation, but we've got the opportunity to make it happen, and I don't think we should back off from it a second.
You mentioned communication, and it reminds me of in the early days, and I think I probably was guilty as much as other people in the public of not giving you guys credit for it being early days. So I own that. But there was, you know, lots of conversations with William Buster about, you know, public engagement, you know, doing, you know, sort of thought-leading sessions and a podcast, or, you know, all these different ways in which the endowment could tell its story more accurately, because it's a complicated issue. And with all due respect, you know, to TV news, a 90-second TV package is not going to get that across. And I think Buster struggled to communicate the enormity and the complexity and the timeline of what he was trying to do through traditional media. And I think it worked better when he could get in a room with people. You know, I watched him at several different events with, you know, 20, 30, 40 people. And those people came away with a much, I think, more clear-eyed and reasonable idea of what the endowment was trying to do than my own reporting or, you know, WCT or WWAY was getting across to the public. Yeah. Do you feel like you guys have, you know, done a better job in more recent years of doing that communication and getting to the public?
Well, you'd hope so. You know, we were a young organization, and William was doing a great job of trying to get that message out. But it's a challenge. You know, you can't describe the mission of the long-term mission of the endowment in a soundbite, which was to your point. You know, it's hard to get it into a soundbite. It's a discussion. It's a and And you've got 13 different perspectives on the board that bring together, and then 250,000 perspectives in the county to bring it together. And so it's complicated, and it's hard to do that. I think the endowment has gotten better. I think evolution over time has gotten better. But again, the endowment's a complicated, you know, it's not a check writing organization. You know, and there are different opinions on the direction, but kind of getting back to the rainbow, you know, there are small grants here, there are transformative grants at the top, and everything in between. So communication is always a challenge, you know, and Lord help me, I found that out, you know, but communication is always a challenge. And I think, you know, under Shannon's leadership, they'll continue to try to do a better job of it.
Since we're talking about staff, and I know that you're not inclined to talk about individual personnel issues, so I won't ask you for the umpteenth time why certain CEOs left, for example. But I do wonder about the endowment as an organization, as a team of men and women who are, as you put it, you know, working their behinds off, working very hard around the clock. The initial sort of administrative team was quite small. And there you have staffed up somewhat, and I've heard, you know, conversations about whether or not that is the right size. You know, I know that you're were one of 13, but what was your perspective? Maybe what were some of the conversations about how big should this organization be? I mean, just to put a fine point on it, I've heard some people say, object to people like me who keep calling it a $1.6 billion foundation and saying, like, we're really, you know, we have an operational budget that is a fraction of that. So right. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there are probably 13 different perspectives on what's the right size of the organization. You know, we've looked at the Dogwood endowment in the West, and we've looked at others, and we're a little bit of a unicorn type endowment. So there's not a blueprint. There's not a handbook that says you need to have X number of employees and here's how they're set up, because we're very unique. You know, we're a small county. We've got $1.5 billion, but you're right. The operational budget is a fraction of that. Our administrative budget is very limited, you know, from that. So there are different opinions on that. You know, we clearly were understaffed early on. I mean, you know, to be honest, you know, not whining, but, you know, I was working 20, 30 hours a week voluntarily, and others were doing the same thing. So we were clearly understaffed. And are we at the right staff level now? My personal opinion is, if we're going to accomplish the change that we want to accomplish, no, we're not. We need more people directly involved in the process. But it's a work in process, you know, again, because there's no handbook and there's no manual. You know, we're building the plane, right? And so you know, our finance committee has a very close eye on it, because the less money we spend on administration, the more money we have to go to the community. And I think all the board members agreed on that. So we're all of the endowment. We run a tight ship. But at the same time, you know, you got to have the horses to run. And so whether we're at the right staff level now, my personal opinion is, no, they need more help. You know, the staff's running full guns, doing everything they can. You know, and I don't know right off the top of my head, but, you know, they're evaluating grants for the rest of this year. And they'll probably put out another, I don't know how much is left for the year that we can, $20, $30 million. That's not chicken scratch, right? That's real money.
Yes.
But they've got like $130 million of request in some level to go through. So, you know, I think we probably need a few more people. But I tell you, the ones we got are good.
So you mentioned, especially that first grant round, I know all of you were spending an inordinate amount of time basically reviewing, you know, just hundreds and hundreds. I forget how many. I think it was 300 some grants.
Yes, it was a lot.
And I had this conversation with you as chair and with Bill Cameron as chair, and about this process of, you know, getting from a very involved fiduciary board to more of a, you know, 30,000 foot governance board. How is that process going along? Because one of the critiques we've heard, again, from both sides of the aisle, is that there seems to be a lot of hands from the board still in the everyday operations, sometimes to the detriment of the CEO's ability to just knuckle down and do their job.
Yeah, it's fits and spurts, but I'll tell you this, and here's the reason why it has been somewhat of a challenge, is that we have 13 dedicated, committed, talented board members. You know, now that I'm off, I can say that. And the new board member, I'm sure, will be the same. They're all successful in their own way. And but this isn't a knife and fork club. You know, this isn't come eat lunch and have a meeting. These people take the responsibility for the endowment incredibly seriously, as they should. And we probably have taken on more of a personal burden than maybe we should. We all take it very personally. I feel comfortable speaking for the others, is that everybody feels very responsible for this money. It's the public's money, and everybody feels very responsible for it. So that creates an environment where you've got engagement. You've got 13 engaged people trying to do the right thing. Now, how do you get from there to that engagement being at a traditional board level? And that's a work in process. And then, unfortunately, with the move in and out of two different CEOs, it's kind of hit fits and spurts. And so I think all the board members recognize it. I think all the board members understand it. One of the challenges with successful people is that successful people think they know how to do things. You know, and so just because you're a good heart surgeon may not make you a good investor or whatever the case may be. And we probably have some of that. And so it's a challenge for those engaged board members to let go. But we've got work to do there. Yeah.
You talk about the personal investment, and I you are not the only former board member who still says we. Yeah. And I think that's admirable. That's not a knock. But I have heard, and I think you and I have talked about this. That level of investment can, for some people, make you risk averse. Because you are taking it so seriously.
Yes,
it is the public's money.
Yes.
And being the first penguin off the iceberg, being the first person to really swing for the fences and miss, which will happen at some point in the endowment's, you know, probably near to medium term future, you know, is that a concern you have for the board of being too invested and too risk averse?
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head, and that's just a human. Listen, I'm a banker. I'm risk averse for a living.
And I want you to be. I want my banker to be very risk averse.
Well, I am risk averse for a living. We, you know, bankers can't afford to make mistakes. We have very thin margins. And so I remember early on when we were developing our original strategic plan and our original mission, vision, and values and words that we were using, and that concept came on, is that we're going to have to take risk and fail sometimes. Because we can do things. One of the reasons we were set up the way we are as a private organization is that we can do things government can't do. And so because of that, we should be willing to take chances and take risks, do new things. And if you do that, you're going to fail. They almost had to give me oxygen. You know, I was going, are you kidding me? I'm not going to do that. But that's exactly. And then I came along, you know, yes, we're going to do that. And so that's in our stated purpose. I mean, we've got it in our in our commitments to each other as board members that we will do that. But you're exactly right. You know, it's hard. It's hard when you're that engaged to, and we've had recent discussions, you know, over grants that way. Well, let's instead of doing a full-fledged big grant, let's cut it down to a small one and let's see how that works. Let's crawl before we walk, before we run. And which is not a terrible strategy, but it's a slow strategy. And if you're getting to transformational change, that's a real slow strategy. And so I kind of pushed back against that. I was willing, you know, being the banker, they brought me full circle, and I was willing to, on the grant we were talking about, do that. But that's kind of where the thinking got. So your question's fair, and I think the answer is yes. It makes it difficult to be. Willing to take risks.
I think there's something that's going to be a sweet spot between an endless series of pilot programs and some sort of Silicon Valley startup move fast and break things philosophy. I don't think a lot of people want to see the endowment move fast and break things.
Yeah.
But I do think, yeah, that to your point, like there's a place that we hope to see the endowment get to where eventually you're willing to take a risk on stuff.
Well, and again, that's just being willing to look the public in the eye and go, we're trying something different here that hadn't been tried. It may not work. You know, and so far, we haven't done much of that.
So we're talking about the board. These are 13 very engaged, very dedicated people, some big personalities on the board also.
You think?
I think. That's my sense. I know some of them. And I've heard lots of euphemisms for the disagreements that have happened. But one thing that I've been curious about is people in the public's desire to see the board makeup strictly in partisan terms of Democrats and Republicans. And it's become my understanding over the last 5 years that that's not really a great skeleton key to figure out where the disagreements and conversations are. So what is your sense of how does politics play a role on that board?
Well, number one, I honestly don't know the political affiliation of the other board members. I mean, there's some that are obvious that have run for office and done other things. But I honestly, with any certainty, couldn't tell you who's a Democrat, Republican, unaffiliated. So that part of it, that part is not as politically concerning as it could be. One challenge we have is that when the endowment was originally set up, it was stated that one of the reasons we're setting up the board appointments the way they are is to make it a non-political organization, an apolitical organization. Well, you know, your household has politics in it. I mean, you know.
I was going to say, I remember Don Munford telling the Board of Commissioners that that was why, and I thought that was a very lofty aspiration, but yeah. I didn't think it was necessarily a realistic aspiration.
Well, listen, there are politics in everything. And so, you know, the first few rounds of appointments, reappointments, stayed consistent with the initial board's desire to keep the politics out of it. And then over the last three, that's changed. So we've changed over, you know, board members, and now it's a little bit of a musical chairs thing. And that's certainly within the legal prerogative of the county commissioners to do that. The challenge is, getting back to the original conversation about the founding documents, the more you do that, you lose institutional knowledge, and you run the risk of making some mistakes along that. The other side of it is it is good to get new voices every now and then. But the voices should be based on competency and that. And I think the challenge is not so much party oriented as I think you were kind of alluding to, but it is the challenge of certain board members introducing their own personal ideology into it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think the endowment should be, you know, for everybody, right? It's the people's money. There's no question about that. It's the people's money that we as board members, and me as a former board member, had the privilege of overseeing. And so keeping personal ideologies, personal politics, I guess, is maybe, I don't know if that's the right way to do it, out of it is the right thing to do, but it's a challenge. And so, And not just the personal ideology of board members, but also of the county commissioners. You know, that's where the responsibility lies in this conversation, because the hospital board who appoint six, they have a very rigid, skills-oriented system of evaluating potential candidates. That's what they do. They have done a remarkable job, just great appointments from the hospital board. They're doing a phenomenal job from day one through, and they've got some appointments coming up into the year, and I'm sure they'll do the same great job. The county commissioners don't use that. Frankly, I don't think they did it when I got appointed 5 years ago, and I don't think they have since then. So those appointments tend to be people that align with the whoever's in charge ideology. And one of the challenges is with some of the actual county commissioners not fully understanding the endowment and what it can and can't do, they run the risk of appointing people with the same mindset that could run the risk of violating the asset purchase agreement. The example of the Commissioner Pierce making the comment about not funding the workforce housing because the endowment. Well, that's a mistake. You know, that's a mistake, and that's where the challenge comes in. So it's not so much what party somebody's in. I think it is the even though there are 13 individual successful people, they've got to come together as one. They've got to come together as and we've done a very good job of that historically, of coming together with a unified vision. But when individuals inject their personal ideology on top of instead of what's good for the group, you know, what do I think's right as opposed to what do we think's right, that's where your problem is, and that's where the politics come in, and that's the real challenge going forward. And I think, you know, the county commissioners are the accountable ones. It's not the endowment board. It is the county commissioners, the ones that are voting to make the appointments, should be accountable for that.
I would argue you should all be accountable.
Well, no, there's no question. Well, I think everybody's holding the endowment board accountable.
I think we are.
And we all feel it and appreciate it. Because yeah. Nobody holds the endowment board more accountable than ourselves. Yeah. And so I think that's the case. But I want to take it further is that the county commissioners need to be held accountable because they're the ones that are making decisions. And they need to be held accountable for understanding what they're doing. So, I don't want to relitigate the budget either, but just understanding what you're doing in the budget means you know that you're cutting nursing positions in the school when you pass a budget. That's understanding what you're doing. The same thing goes for appointments to the endowment board.
I think that is a very fair point. So I want to take two things that you just said and touch on both of them. One is about this issue of ideology, and it is to me from my vantage point. Kind of a strange situation because you have people who might act and feel and vote in a certain way on the county commission when it comes to the use of public money. And I'm specifically talking here about issues of equity. You know, when there are some members of the community who are going to benefit more from a government program than others. That's basically the heart and soul of equity, right? Not everyone needs the same amount to get to the same
finish
goal.
Line. Yeah.
So, and there is quite a bit of political pushback against that. The Trump administration has been pretty rigorously against that and has sought ways to, you know, financially basically hamstring public organizations that engage in equity, call it DEI, call it whatever you want. But it feels like there is a difference between what government should do and what the endowment should do.
No question.
And it feels to me at least like there is... It is a different environment, and that the same fiscal conservative who might say we want to cut this program as a commissioner or a city councilor or something like that might feel quite differently in the endowment. And I say all this because equity is hardwired into, you know, the founding documents in the asset purchase agreement, you know, health and social equity. And is that a thing you guys have struggled with, the difference between what we might debate that a government should do versus what the endowment should do?
Yeah, and again, one of the brilliant things the originating county commissioners did was to set this up to avoid those kind of governmental political conversations. You know, DEI or equity, whatever, has taken on such a political connotation.
No doubt that
people can argue that forever, and it's unfortunate because you know equity means fairness. Right? Equitable, fairness, what's fair. And so nobody's against fairness, right? I mean, I've never met anybody that says, oh, well, let's treat people unfairly. You know, so everybody's in favor of fairness. So, I've encouraged the when this issue has popped its head up a time or two, I've just encouraged the board members to think of fairness. You know, what's fair in what we do? And we're not subject to governmental restrictions, regulations, et cetera. It is hardwired into our asset purchase agreement, and we've translated that into our mission, vision, values, and commitment, and it's there. But it's just fairness. And as a private organization, we can do fair things. And I think when you do fair things, you know, and again, you know, fair is not equal. Fair is fair, right? And so I think as long as we continue to do fair things, and I've stood up for that, you know, in a few conversations that have come up, which, you know, may have led me being a former director, you know, but that's okay. I mean, you know, it is what it is. But again, I think we need to take the politics, we need to take the unnecessary emotion out of it and just think what is fair for all the citizens in New Hanover County.
I mean, and to that point, and I won't ask you to speculate on whether or not this led to Dan Winslow not being CEO anymore, but I heard him say two rather distinctly different things. And one is that, and this has become something of a catchphrase for conservatives in social media posts, is that the endowment is for everyone, right? And to me, that reads as they would like to see the endowment issue grants that benefit the maximum number of people. And I've heard objections from folks on the right to grants that, you know, focus on just one minority group or one marginalized community. And on the other hand, I heard Winslow say quite clearly that there are some people in our community who have not been treated fairly historically, and that, you know, doing right by them will require more resources, which is just a way of saying more money, than doing right by other people in the community. And, he seemed in our conversations to be able to hold both of those ideas in his head at the same time. And I think with $85 million a year, you could probably serve both masters. But that's, I think that's the tension that I'm trying to drill down on here, is that there are some folks who I feel would like to see the endowment, you know, do things like, you know, perhaps universal child care, something that every man, woman, and child in New Hanover County could benefit from. And some people who felt like something like addressing a food desert in the north side, which did not benefit everyone in the community. Definitely help was going to, you know, could potentially help a group of people who need that help. But you can't really argue effectively that that was for everyone. So how did that tension play out to the extent that you can talk about that?
Well, one is, you make a good point. We've got a lot of money available every year. There is no reason why we almost can't do it all. You know, I struggle with people putting issues on the table and say it's one way or the other. It doesn't have to be that way. If you have collaboration and communication and people working together like it's supposed to, you can do it all. You really can. Now, those philosophical or ideological kind of conversations can get frustrating, and there's really, I don't think, a direct place for it in the endowment. I mean, it's been very clear that we want to be fair, we want to treat, and we can do things that benefits all 250,000 people. We can do things that raise the tide in one certain area. But if it raises the tide in one certain area, it helps the other people. You know, I mean, it really does. It's indirect, but again, I think that the decisions aren't race-based, really. They're economic-based. It's economic-based. And people that are in a position where, for one reason or another, they're economically underprivileged, that creates financial burdens on the entire community. And so if that group of people, if they can get a job, they can get a job, they can, you know, the unhoused conversation from last several weeks, if more of those people can be housed or have jobs or have functions, well, then that just saves resources from the rest. So even the initiatives that look like they are focused on a certain economic group really benefit the entire county.
All right, so let's get to the elephant in the room. We waited long enough. You alluded to this a couple of times, and this is the appointment process that took place this week.
Wasn't that fun?
Which was, if you were just a casual viewer, struck some people as extremely odd. But having, you know, talked to a few people, it now seems like you had Vice Chair Leanne Pierce. From all I can tell, and she has not responded to my texts and phone messages, and I don't want to put words in her mouth.
Mine either, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, you made that point. But it does seem like she was accusing you of, in some way, shape, or form, trying to run against her. And I don't know if she meant, you know, as a county commissioner or hiring someone, in fact, or sponsoring someone to primary her, or if Ted Davis ever retires, running against her for Davis's seat for House Rep. I don't know if you have any more clarity on that, but what was your experience of that?
Well, I was there, so I've got absolute clarity.
All right, let's go.
And, you know, communication, we talked earlier, is two sides of it. It's what one person says and what other person chooses to hear. And this is personal to me, because what the vice chair accused me of is telling her that if you don't support me for the endowment seat, I will run against you for county commissioner. That's what she said.
Okay.
That is incorrect, not the truth. Matter of fact, it's 180 degrees from the truth. How she got there, I do not know. All I know is what I said and how she took that with her other two commissioners that she said she had to consult and got to that point. I have no idea. But let me be crystal clear. Is that, you know, I made the comment yesterday, you know, I was raised the youngest of four boys, a skinny kid in a tough neighborhood. I've never threatened anybody in my life, maybe my kids when they were younger. But outside of that, and I certainly haven't threatened a county commissioner. And I never said I wanted to run for county commissioner. I never said, if you don't do this, I'll do it. That just didn't happen. It just did not happen. Let me tell you what did happen. So, you know, as in anybody that's up for a board appointment, it's wise for them to contact the county commissioners and make their case. And I've done the same thing. I contacted the chairman, the vice chairman, talked to the chairman a couple of times. And in July, I called the vice chair. We missed each other a few times, finally connected. And so we had a very cordial, pleasant, I consider Leanne a friend. You know, we had, you know, some of it was personal chat, and then we, you know, whatever. And I was making my case to be reappointed. In making my case, you know, I made the comment that in the next few years, there's a chance that I'll have more time available to me, and I want to dedicate it to more public service, and I want to dedicate it to the endowment. I want to be focused on it. I'm committed to it. I've been there from the beginning, and that's what I want to do. To reemphasize that point, I said this. I have actually been contacted by a number of people encouraging me to run for county commissioner. I do not want to do that. And I said it at least three times. I do not want to do that. And the reason for making that mention was to say, I don't want to do that. I want to be on the endowment board. You know, that's the alpha and the omega of it. I mentioned it three times that I don't want to do that. Just to continue, it got bizarre. That was in February. It got bizarre.
You mean that was in August or July?
I'm sorry, not February. I'm in July. Yeah. It was in July.
And just for a second, just to play devil's advocate, because Leon Pierce is not here, is it possible, you know, in hindsight, that given, I don't know, whatever heightened political pressures we all seem to be under these days, that she read something between the lines that wasn't there, but thought you were saying, oh, I really, really don't want to run from commissioner, and so if I'm on the endowment, that won't happen?
Well, if I was in the conversation, and I would answer that and say no. Now, you know, how somebody internalizes things, you know, that's up to them. You know, you and I internalize things differently, and the vice chair differently. So I can't speak to her for that and how she, but she had no concern on the conversation. If that was a concern to her, that's the point in time that it's easy to go, well, Spence, I don't feel comfortable with this. What did you just say? You know, we chit-chatted about other things and went on. And so she showed no concern whatsoever. None. Not a bit. And so I'd have to say that if she did read something between the lines and she had concern, you know, that was her phone conversation, actually. I mean, she's the county commissioner. She easily could have said that. And what really kind of hammers that point home is where it got a little bizarre is about a month later, the county manager came to me delivering a message that he said was from Commissioner Scalise in consultation with Commissioner Pierce that he was the go-through. He was very uncomfortable.
Was this by phone or text? Or
no, face-to-face.
Face-to-face.
I mean, and he was very uncomfortable. I could tell he didn't want to be there. And in my opinion is he felt awkward being put in an awkward position, and I support him feeling that way. But according to him, they had given him a message to deliver to me. Now, they could have called me. I've got a cell phone. They've got my cell phone number, but they didn't. They asked the county manager, and the message was this, that if you do not withdraw your application to the endowment board, we are going to go public that you threatened Commissioner Pierce. And I almost couldn't breathe. I mean, it's the first it hit me. I went, what are you talking about? He goes, that's just my message. That's what he told me to do. And so I sat there and I thought, well, number one, why do they want me to withdraw my application? Nobody even told me they weren't supporting me. You know, what was that all about? But then this whole thing of threatening a county commissioner, it floored me.
And this was like right before Labor Day, like 2 weeks ago.
It was on Friday before Labor Day.
Yeah.
August 29th. I remember it. It was about 2 in the afternoon. I mean, I remember exactly the conversation. And I said, Chris, I don't know what to say other than that is blatantly false. I did not do that. And now I'm kind of painted into a corner. I can't withdraw my application. I mean, that's a threat, you know. And in this whole world thing, I just have to say I was threatened. I was threatened through not the county manager, but by those two commissioners through the county manager. I was the one that was threatened, the vice chair. And it just took me, so off guard, and I didn't understand it. So I thought about it through the weekend. And so then on Monday, you know, Labor Day, I called and didn't get connect with Commissioner Pierce. So I sent her a text, a very, very clear text that it basically said that with the conversation with the county manager, it's clear that you understood what I said 180 degrees from where it was intended, That was never the intent, and it was a personal thing. I said, I would never do anything to jeopardize my friendship with you and her significant other. And I said, you know, it's not worth it. You're not worth a board seat. So please call me back, and so we can chat about that. And no answer to my text, no call back. And so this goes on until, you know, until, and so I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. So, and then, so we come to the what I'd call a fiasco yesterday. It was embarrassing watching the county commissioners. You know, I think we deserve better. I think I deserve better as a citizen. I deserve better. You know, I'm a public servant. I'm a volunteer board member who's put in hundreds of hours on that, and I got threatened to withdraw. And again, you guess what you want to. Why would anybody want my application withdrawn? I mean, you vote against me like you did. I mean, I didn't understand that. So that was really confusing. I feel like I was threatened, and to this day, I tried to call. I followed up with another text. Tried to call. I saw Commissioner Pierce at the Power Breakfast last week, and she couldn't avoid me. And she said, "I got your text. I'm going to call you this afternoon," which was last Friday. She did not call me. She didn't call me all weekend. I texted again the morning, Monday morning, and then you saw the rest of it.
I saw the rest of it, and we'll have links to that. And I can just say for people who are listening to this, you know, we reached out to the county and asked for Chris's point of view, and we would love to hear from Leanne Pierce.
Let me make crystal clear. Chris Coudray was not part of this. Chris Coudray was I think it's unprofessional for the two county commissioners to put their county manager in that awkward position. I think that was very unprofessional. I'm not going to speak for him how he feels about it. I thought it was unprofessional, uncalled for, and just totally out of line. Just totally out of line. And if they wanted to say that, they could just call me and tell me. You know, I don't know why they did that. But anyway, it's unprofessional. I think our county deserves better. I think our citizens deserve better. I think we deserve better than what we saw on the dais yesterday, Monday. And I just encourage everybody. You know, I think everybody needs to be focused on that issue. They need to be focused on accountability and focused on the endowment continuing to meet its obligations under the asset purchase agreement.
All right. Well, I've taken a lot of your time, but before I let you go, I want to ask two sort of classic journalist questions. One is there anything during your 5 years on the board that you regret and would have done differently?
Yeah, we wouldn't. If I had to do again, we wouldn't have done that first round of grants. That first year, we rushed them. We heard them. We got so much input from the community. Get money out. Get money out. We know you got it. You know, get money out. And we didn't have the infrastructure. We didn't have the. We were volunteers. I think we had just hired a CEO, but he was brand new. We had no staff. And we felt pressure from the community to get money out. And so we spent, as you mentioned earlier, I don't know how many hours grinding through, and we're not qualified to do that. We're just not. And so one regret, that is the regret I have. We should have passed on that, had some backbone, told the community, look, we've got to get our infrastructure in place first. So we rushed that first round of grants. Now, they were all good grants, right? They went to good people, good organizations doing good work. So certainly not wasted money, but there was no strategy behind it. There was no organization behind it. And I would have done that differently if I had a chance to do it again.
All right. And the last question I want to ask you is, you know, you weren't appointed on Monday, but if you had been, you know, what would have been the most important thing for you to accomplish over that last term on the endowment?
Well, again, we all hear about accountability, and I think all the board members feel accountable. I think we should be more accountable to the public. I've made that comment in our board members' meetings, and how we do that is a challenge. But I would like to see more transparency. I'd like to see us, I'd like to see us continue to adhere to our strategic plan, because we've got a good strategic plan. Let's keep working it forward, you know, again, I'm a governance geek. You know, I would like to just make sure that we're following the rules as we continue to move on. And I would encourage everybody to hold the endowment and county commissioners, you know, responsible.
All right. Well, Spence Broadhurst, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Okay. Well, that's about it for this edition of The Newsroom. Before we go, a quick editorial note here about Broadhurst's descriptions of the events involving New Hanover County Commissioners Dane Scalise and Leanne Pierce and County Manager Chris Coudray. In an email, Coudray confirmed that he spoke with Broadhurst on the Friday before Labor Day, saying it happened, quote, after a request made of me. Coudray added that he would have liked to consider his discussions with individual commissioners and other persons as private. Coudray declined to respond to additional questions, but he did not contest that he spoke with Broadhurst after a conversation with Commissioner Scalise. Nor did he dispute that he had asked Broadhurst to withdraw his application or the county might go public with their concerns that Broadhurst had threatened to challenge Pierce politically. In a text message, Scalise confirmed that he had spoken with Pierce, who was very upset and felt that Broadhurst was trying to intimidate or bully her, and considered it improper and an ethical breach. Scalise confirmed he called Coudray to say he felt that, based on Pierce's account, Broadhurst's comments were disqualifying. He said he told Coudray that he would be discussing Broadhurst's, quote, quid pro quo offer in public if he persisted with his nomination request. We'll have a full copy of his comments on the show page. For her part, Pierce has not responded to texts, voice messages, or email. But, of course, the newsroom door always remains open. All right, well, that's today's show. Thanks again to our guest, Spence Broadhurst. Music for this show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.